Welcome, everyone, to the fourth live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name is Christy Peoples. I'm a producer here at Sounds True, and I'll be your host. Today, Ron Siegel will be teaching on the neurobiology of mindfulness, practical applications of the new science. He's broadcasting live, while the Sounds True team and I are also live here in our Boulder studios. A free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours, and if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce you to Ron Siegel. Dr. Ronald Siegel is Assistant Professor of Psychology at Harvard Medical School, where he's taught for more than 30 years. He's a longtime student of mindfulness meditation, and he serves on the board of directors and faculty at the Institute for Meditation and Psychotherapy. He is the author of The Mindfulness Solution, Everyday Practices for Everyday Problems, and he's the co-author of Back Sense, a revolutionary approach to halting the cycle of chronic back pain and sitting together, essential skills for mindfulness-based psychotherapy. He's also co-edited Mindfulness and Psychotherapy, Second Edition. Welcome, Ron.
Glad to be here. So, the last time I was in London, I asked my cab driver about his training and what kind of test he needed to get licensed. And it turned out that he had to know 25,000 streets and 20,000 landmarks, and the training took about 3 years. And I was curious about this because of my own history as a New York City cab driver. When I trained to be a New York City cab driver, I needed to know 10 locations, and two of them were the same. They were Madison Square Garden and Penn Station. And I only had to get 60% right. And I was able to take the test up to 3 times in 1 day. Not too challenging. But the reason I was interested in my cabbie's experience in London wasn't just to compare it to my own as a New York cab driver. It was because London cabbies have been the test group, or one of the first groups, to really demonstrate what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity. Because London cabbies, it turns out, have had their brain scanned before and after their 3 years of training. And what happens is the hippocampus, which is a part of the brain that's associated with memory, actually grows dramatically in London cabbies. So the study of London cabbies really was one of the watersheds in helping us to see that, unlike what I learned early in my training, which was that the brain develops maximum maturity and sophistication at age 25 and begins to deteriorate after that, it's transformed us from believing that to understanding that the brain is much more like a muscle, and it's a kind of use it or lose it phenomena. Now, the relationship between the brain and the mind is curious because different philosophic systems posit different sorts of relationships. The mind changes the brain and the brain changes the mind. And I'm sorry, I haven't been suggesting this. We should be on that slide. We could think of the mind as being like the software. It has to do with the information or data being processed and what we're experiencing directly in consciousness. And we can think of the brain more as like hardware. It has to do with the neural structures and activity, and the brain can be observed through dissection, through chemical and neural activity, and through imaging. Next slide. Now, why does neurobiology matter? Well, it matters for a number of reasons. It turns out that many mindfulness practices, which we're now incorporating into Western psychotherapeutic work and into Western well-being programs more generally, many of them come from Asian cultures. And in fact, many of them come from religious cultures. And there's often skepticism about them in Western populations that are taking them on. So if we can actually demonstrate that there are changes to brain structure and brain function brought about by these practices, we're likely to get buy-in. We're likely to both get buy-in from clients or patients or others who might be interested in taking up these practices. And in fact, insurers are much more willing to pay for a service that includes changing the brain than they are for something that sounds like it comes from a religious tradition. So we can use neurobiological studies to develop interest in the practices, to build confidence for people who are involved in the practices, and to begin to see experience as an impersonal process. As a neurobiologist, Wolf Singer, puts it, the brain is like an orchestra without a conductor. And so often in clinical work, and I'm a clinical psychologist by training, so often what we see is that people feel tormented by their thoughts and feelings and feel that there's something terribly wrong with them, with themselves for having various thoughts and feelings. And to begin to see that it's not so much about me, it's more about the brain doing what it evolved to do, can be very, very helpful. And seeing mindfulness practices as addressing some of these hardwired propensities of the brain that cause a lot of suffering can develop a lot of buy-in for the mindfulness subjects, for the mindfulness practices. And it also opens the door, obviously, to our understanding how the brain and the mind work and to novel interventions like neurofeedback. There's a, the next slide, please. There's a Zen koan that says, intending to buy iron, they obtain gold. And this has been interpreted in various ways, but the gist of it is that people may come into this with an interest in, oh, I'm going to train, you know, change my brain function or my brain structure, but they're going to get a whole lot more out of it. They're actually going to have the possibility of having a transformed relationship to experience and a transformed relationship to the nature of self, to who we think we are. So studying the neurobiology actually can bring people in and can be a gateway to this kind of more radical transformation. So let me step back a little and say a few words about what mindfulness is. I think, you know, mindfulness is so widespread now in the culture that many of our listeners probably are aware of it, but just a few words. So mindfulness, as we're using it in Western psychological circles and as we're studying it in the laboratory, is actually a translation of a Pali term. And Pali was the vernacular language in which the teachings of the historical Buddha were first written down. And the word sati, the word in Pali is sati, and sati connotes awareness, attention, and remembering. And the awareness and attention part are pretty much the way we use them in English, to be aware and to pay attention. But the remembering is different. It's not about remembering what we had for breakfast, or for that matter, even remembering childhood trauma. It's about remembering to be aware and to pay attention. And there's a bit of a controversy in mindfulness circles these days in the West as to how comprehensive a term sati is. And one critic, a Buddhist scholar named John Dunn at Emory University, he raises the following objection. He says, imagine a sniper poised on top of a building, getting ready to take out an innocent victim. That sniper would be very aware, very attentive, and every time his mind wandered, he'd be bringing it right back to the task at hand. And Dr. Dunn says, I don't think that kind of consciousness is exactly what you're trying to cultivate in yourselves as psychotherapists, in well-being programs, or for that matter, in clients or participation in mindfulness programs. Something's missing. And as a psychologist, I like to think of what's missing as the Rogers, Carl and Mister. Carl Rogers, as you may remember from IntroPsych, if you're not in the mental health field, was exquisitely attuned to empathic resonance. He's usually the first thing taught in counseling classes, and it's about how to be with another person's experience and reflect it back to them. And Mr. Rogers, as of course you know, has, you know, a little over the top, but a presentation of, it's okay, sweetheart, you're fine the way you are. So adding this in, it adds a kind of sense of non-judgment or acceptance to the experience. So putting this together, we could say that therapeutic mindfulness, or mindfulness as we're studying it in the laboratory, is about awareness of present experience with acceptance. And it actually turns out that if you ask people, are they aware of their present experience with acceptance, most of them will say yes if they haven't had a lot of experience with mindfulness practice. If they have had a lot of experience, then they tend to say, well, not so frequently. Because what we notice is that so much of the time our mind is wandering. We're either operating on autopilot, where the body is doing one thing and the mind is elsewhere. We're thinking about the future or the past, you know. How many of you had the thought before I... at some point when I started this presentation, I wonder if this guy's going to be any good. I wonder if I should listen tonight. That's a thought about the future, right? Trying to figure out, is this going to be good for me? Am I going to be gratified by it? And we're always concerned about missing out on experiences. We spend a lot of time, you know, when I go in the shower is a potentially very rich sensual experience with water adjusted to just the right temperature, caressing my naked body. A lot's going on there, but I'm perfectly capable of spending the entire shower in the thought stream, thinking about the past and the future. And that's, and in addition to that, there's all the time we spend trying to get to the good stuff. You know, let me get through my paperwork so I can go home. Let me get through this traffic so I can get to my friend's house or get through these dishes to have a cup of tea. So what we start to see when we take up mindfulness practices is that much of the time we're actually not mindful at all. But with sustained attention and with doing these practices repeatedly, we actually can develop the capacity to be more present. And this is helpful for dealing with a number of challenges. And I just want to address a few of them that are most relevant really to understanding the neurobiology of mindfulness practices. One of the challenges, which you may have noticed, is that everything changes so that it's impossible to hold on to anything. And this causes a lot of suffering. And this starts very early. You know, I don't want to give up my diapers and start using the potty. The current arrangement suits me just fine. School with all those weird people, I'd just as soon stay home with mommy and daddy. And this goes on, you know, throughout developmental stages. And here I am in my 60s, and I think my next big developmental stage is probably assisted living. And even if they're playing the Stones for my entire generation, I don't think I'll be embracing it. How about you? Have you noticed any changes in your body since you were 20? Have you welcomed and embraced all of those? So change is very, very hard for us and causes a great deal of suffering as we try to resist it. And as we'll see, the changes that are most difficult for us are the ones that affect us personally or those close to us. And we'll see as we look at the neurobiology of mindfulness that mindfulness practices can help us to be with moment-to-moment experience more richly, more readily, with less holding on and less resisting. Next slide. The problem with selfing. Some people say this picture reminds them of a certain political candidate. I'm not sure what they might, or political figure. I'm not sure what they may be referring to. You know, one of the things that causes a lot of suffering and where the neurobiology of mindfulness can give us tips as to how to work with this has to do with our endless, endless thinking about ourselves. And this takes many, many different forms. I remember traveling to some African game parks, and the naturalist would point out patterns, and the same pattern would repeat over and over and over. There would be some dominant male associating with a reproductively promising set of females. And then there would be some other males over in the next field doing the species-specific equivalent of playing basketball, honing their skills to try to be the dominant male. And you would see constant jockeying for dominance in these mammalian groups. In fact, you know, Robert Sapolsky, who spent a life studying stress physiology, watching baboon troops behind blinds of vegetation in the African savanna, and then anesthetizing the troops and drawing blood. And he was asked, you know, so has anything stood out over all these years of studying them? He said, yes, there is one really, really robust finding. It turns out that it is very bad for your health to be a low-ranking male in a baboon troop. And we may think that these concerns for social dominance or rank in the troop don't affect us so much. But the way they show up in human beings is thinking about ourselves in terms of social comparisons, which is really thinking about self-esteem. And this takes so many different forms because there are so many different ways in which we compare ourselves to other people. You know, for one person, it's, to go back to the slide, you know, who's richer or more powerful? For someone else, it's who's more intelligent. For someone else, it's who's kinder. For someone else, it's who has more friends. For someone else, it's who has the better behaved or better looking or more highly achieving children, or the better behaved, better looking, and more highly achieving spouse or partner. And the comparisons go on and on. Who's more creative? Who's more playful? Who's more spontaneous? Who's more physically fit? Who's thinner? Who looks younger when you get older? On and on and on. Among meditators, this is really funny. It becomes a competition for who makes fewer social comparisons, who's less concerned with their social rank. But unless we live in Lake Wobegon, where all of the women are strong, the men are good looking and all of the children are above average, we're likely to win and lose. How about you? Do you always win? I once asked that question of a group and a guy raised his hand and I thought, avoid him at lunch. You know, you wouldn't want to be with somebody who thinks that he always wins. So this concern with who we are and how we compare to others causes untold suffering for us, because there's no way to consistently come out on top. So it becomes a very, very unreliable source of well-being for us. Next slide. So let's put this in perspective by going back, not to the African game parks, but to our ancestors on the African savanna. And this is an artist's conception of Lucy that you're looking at. And she's our great, 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 et cetera, grandmother. And she was hanging out on the African savanna, 3.5-4 million years ago. And we know she survived because we have her DNA. But how did she survive? If she came face to face with a lion, what could she do? She could grit her teeth and bare her claws, but that wouldn't be terribly effective. And she wasn't very fast. If you go to the game parks and do a walking tour, you know, one of the first things the guides tell you is, no matter what happens, don't run. Why? Because everything scary that's out there is faster than you are. You see that lumbering hippopotamus in the mud puddle? 42 miles an hour when he gets going. You see the half-blind rhino behind the tree? 38 miles an hour. You're not going to outrun them. And in fact, if they're predators and you run, they're going to think you're prey. So that wasn't going to work. Sense of hearing was okay. Her vision was okay, better than the rhino, not as good as a giraffe. But how did she survive? I mean, her hide wasn't going to offer a great deal of protection. So she had a few things going for her. She had a prehensile thumb, the ability to pick up objects. That was helpful. She had the fight or flight system that other mammals had developed quite nicely, and that helps for emergency action. And what she particularly had that set her aside from the others was the capacity to think. And if we look at the next slide, we see that it is this capacity to think that can get us into trouble, because the capacity to think causes us to constantly review the past for pleasure or pain and try to figure out how to maximize future pleasure and avoid future pain. But the problem with our minds this way and our brains is that they're not some kind of neutral thinking apparatus, but they have a very strong negativity bias. Those of you who tuned into Rick Hansen yesterday evening, I suspect that he would have talked about the negativity bias because he's a student of that. And in fact, he has a wonderful phrase. He says that the mind is like Velcro for bad experiences and Teflon for good ones. Bad experiences stick, good ones slide right off the pan. And this is because on the African savanna, we could have made one of two types of errors. And we can call them type one errors and type two errors because they roughly correspond to those errors in research studies. A type one error would involve looking at some ambiguous stimulus like, a beige shape behind some green bushes and go, oh my gosh, it's a lion, when it's really just a beige rock. A type two error would be to say, I think it's just a beige rock, when it's really a lion. Now, we could make countless type 1 errors and still live to tell. One type 2 error, it's the end of our DNA line. So we might imagine that there were happy hominids holding hands, singing kumbaya, remembering dynamite sexual encounters and luscious pieces of fruit. They typically were not our ancestors, because they statistically died before reproducing. Our ancestors were the ones out there going, oh my God, a lion, looks like a snake, could be a cliff, that might be a poisonous plant. And they bequeath that to us. So that's why when we take up mindfulness practices, we see that so often the mind is filled with anxious, frightened, or critical thoughts. So mindfulness practices evolved cross-culturally to help us with all of this, to be able to embrace reality, the fact that everything changes and we can't come out on top all the time, to develop metacognitive awareness, to see our thoughts as thoughts so we don't just believe in them, to loosen our preoccupation with self, and we'll get into that in some depth, and to become freer to act skillfully. So let's now turn to the neurobiology of mindfulness. It turns out that it is very challenging to study. And there are two broad realms that we look at. We look at state effects, which is what's happening moment by moment in the mind. And we look at trait effects, which is what's the effects of the mindfulness practice on the mind and the brain over time. So the first is what's happening in the brain right now while I'm meditating. The second is, how do these practices change the brain? And this is easier said than done. And let's go to the slide about that. State changes, there's a lot of challenges. What is the meditator actually doing right now? Is he or she concentrating on the breath, enjoying a pleasant memory, remembering to run an errand? We don't know unless we ask. So whatever we're seeing on our imaging, when the person's, quote, meditating, it's going to be very different depending on what the person's actually doing. And easier said than done, too, trait challenges are very difficult. What are the enduring effects of meditation? Because the problem is, it is very difficult to randomly assign people to either 10 years of intensive meditation practice or a control group. People don't sign up for studies like that. So we can only compare people who have been meditating generally to people who have not. And of course, only certain people tend to meditate. It's very difficult to get a random sample. Maybe we're studying high education, which goes along with meditating. Maybe we're studying who's a vegetarian, and that's what's causing the changes in the brain. So this is not so easy to study. And that's studying brain structure. Brain function is also challenging to study. So let's look, though, at some of the things that we've learned. Okay, one thing, and this will be no surprise, that we found through the studies is that doing meditation practice, doing mindfulness practice, where you begin with attending to some sensory experience, and every time the mind wanders, you bring the attention back to that sensory experience in the present, and you do this over and over, allowing thoughts to come and go, improves our attention. That's not a surprise. We're practicing developing attention, and much as if we practiced lifting weights with our bicep would get stronger. Here, practicing this makes our attentional capacity stronger. And we have improvements in a number of things. We have improved sustained attention, as well as improved detection of unexpected stimuli. And this includes things like alerting, being aware when something's going on, and what's called conflict monitoring, which is paying attention even though there are distractions. We basically get better at this kind of paying attention. And we also have less attentional blink and less habituation. So what's attentional blink? Attentional blink is if you do a study of attention and you give two stimuli very close to one another, usually in a person who's not a meditator, experiencing the first stimulus will make the person miss the second one because they'll start thinking about or paying attention to or reacting to the first stimulus. In meditators, more if you do two in rapid succession, they actually notice both of them more readily. And the other thing is habituation. And those of you who have done much mindfulness practice and, for example, have done an eating meditation will notice that, if you're eating a raisin mindfully, a single raisin is a very rich experience, and you can eat a second one, and it is a very rich experience, and a third one, and it's a very rich experience. We don't habituate so much, whereas when we're not being so mindful and we're living in the thought stream and we eat a raisin, we're not actually tasting the raisin. We're thinking, oh, that's a raisin. And then we're going on to other thoughts. And we said, I already had a raisin. I'm not interested in another one. So we habituate to it and we don't notice the stimulus anymore. And this is true whether there are studies about ringing bells, for example, where people who are experienced mindfulness practitioners hear each bell and the brain responds to each bell, whereas people who are novices, they start to tune out the bell after a while. So mindfulness practices help us to pay attention, which of course has many potential benefits, but they also make our life richer and more alive because we're able to pay attention to what's happening moment by moment. Next slide refers to some of the cognitive skills that remain more intact for meditators. Older meditators outperform their age-matched controls in the attentional blink test that I just mentioned, in short-term memory, in perceptual speed, how quickly they can notice things, in executive functioning, the ability to step back and have perspective and think logically about priorities, and in sustained attention, which I mentioned. So all of these developments are good news, and they're useful for us, but they're also good news because there are ways to introduce these practices to people and perhaps interest them in giving them a try, even though they might be a little difficult to do at the beginning. Something else that we find is an increase in what's called fluid intelligence. And fluid intelligence is exactly what we need in the modern world. This is in contrast to crystallized intelligence, which is things like knowing the state capitals, knowing facts, that kind of stuff. And that's very useful, but you can Google that stuff. Fluid intelligence is the ability to think logically, to solve problems in novel situations, and it's independent of acquired or crystal intelligence or acquired knowledge. And to be flexible in the world and to be able to handle problems and, frankly, to be able to change jobs as people do more and more frequently, having improved fluid intelligence is really helpful. So it turns out mindfulness practices help us with that as well. So how are these things studied? Well, there's a number of different ways that we have to see what the brain is doing when a person's meditating. Those are the state effects. And to see what are the trait effects, what are the results of mindfulness meditation over time. And one of them involves the EEG, electroencephalographs. Excuse me. And let's look at the slide of that. This is the picture of Mathieu Ricard in Richard Davidson's lab. He's done a great deal of research on this at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And Mathieu Ricard is the guy who's known as the happiest man alive. And I'll explain why in a moment. So these EEG studies are very sensitive to moment-to-moment changes. They really see what's happening in the brain moment by moment, but it's a relatively blurry image. You can see it's a series of electrodes put on the outside of the skull, so it's not going to give you an exact measure of what's happening in each brain structure. And what we find with EEG studies is it's complicated. Different types of meditation yield all sorts of different results. In fact, Buddhist lamas who were asked to do different kinds of meditation practices, to say, do compassion practices, and then do loving kindness practices, and then do concentration practices, or what's called focused attention practices, or open monitoring mindfulness practices, where you open the field of awareness to whatever predominates in awareness. People asked to do these different practices found different EEG patterns with the different practices. There's some evidence that deep relaxation may be associated with high theta and delta waves. These have to do with frequency of brain waves that are picked up on EEG. Theta and delta are associated with usually with being asleep, deep sleep, or even actually being unconscious. And concentration and mindfulness practices may be associated with more alpha and beta. Those are the higher frequency brain waves that are usually associated with being consciously alert, but could also be agitated or afraid. And alpha has to do with being aware of one's environment while there's physical and mental relaxation. The take-home point here is it's complicated, and there are different brain patterns associated with different activities. So how come Richard Davidson is called the happiest man alive? No, I'm sorry. Richard Davidson studied Mathieu Ricard. Mathieu Ricard, the happiest man alive. So Mathieu Ricard is a Tibetan Lama, but he wasn't always a Tibetan Lama. He started out as a French scientist. He has a PhD, and he was a research scientist. But he became a Tibetan Lama. And he spent tens of thousands of hours doing mindfulness practices and compassion practices and others. And Richie Davidson invited him to his lab in Madison, and he wired him up in the high-resolution EEG that you saw. And he looked at difference in brain activity between the left prefrontal areas and the right prefrontal areas. And what do we know about this generally? From studies that Richie Davidson did with all sorts of subjects, college sophomores, but others as well. We know that when there's a lot of left prefrontal cortical activity, that happens when people are happy, enthusiastic, engaged, states of mind that we tend to think of as positive or desirable. When there's a lot of right prefrontal activation, that's associated with being hypervigilant, oh my God, it's a lion, or being depressed or being anxious. So we know that from studying normal people. When Richie studied Mathieu Ricard, he found that he was off the charts in the degree of left prefrontal activation. In other words, the lateralization, the degree to which he was activated more in the left side than the right side, was quite extreme. So that's how he got the moniker of the happiest man alive, because his brain looked happier than other brains did. And other senior Tibetan lamas were later studied, and they were similarly very left-sided. In terms of lateralization of activation. in the prefrontal lobe. But Richie Davidson's a very skilled researcher, and he raised the obvious question, which is, might it be that Matthieu Ricard and these other lamas were this way from birth or this way from wonderful childhood experiences? Maybe it wasn't about the tens of thousands of hours of meditation practice. Maybe it was something else, because after all, we didn't have a longitudinal study. We just knew that they were different. In fact, maybe people who are naturally happy this way become lamas. So what he did was he constructed a study with biotech workers. And let's look at the next slide about this. They taught mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a 8-week structured mindfulness course, about 3 hours a week times 8 weeks to a group of biotech workers. And these were pretty stressed out biotech workers. So everybody in the group leaned right, had a lot more right prefrontal activation before the study. And what they did was they randomly assigned half the biotech workers to the mindfulness training for 8 weeks. And then they took a look at their brains after 8 weeks. And guess what? The people who had been through the training, but not the people who had not been through the training, were now leaning more to the left. They had more left prefrontal activation. And in fact, they gave everybody a flu shot halfway through the study and found that those who had been through the training had a more robust immunological response to the flu vaccine as well. So their immune system seemed to be operating somewhat better. And then they gave the control group that was just waiting, they gave them the 8-week course and they caught up to their compatriots. So it really seemed quite clear that it is the mindfulness practice and that in as little as 8 weeks of practice, we can see these changes in brain function. And the next slide saying left-right differences is just a picture from the research study, a graph showing these differences that were found. So let's go on to the slide about neuroimaging studies, because another way that we can look at these, how both the state effects and the trait effects of mindfulness practice involves functional MRI and PET scans and MRIs. So what are these? So functional MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, is probably familiar to most of us because when you have a soft tissue injury in a joint or a muscle, frequently MRIs are done because they're good at picking up what's going on in soft tissue. And a static MRI is like a snapshot of what's happening in the brain. And it has very good resolution, but it only tells you what's happening at the moment that the camera takes the picture, if you will. A functional MRI is like an MRI video, except it's kind of jerky video because it takes a while to resolve each image. So it's like frame, 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 frame. It's not very smooth video, and the resolution isn't quite as good. PET scanning we don't use so much. That's positron emission tomography because you have to inject a radioactive substance into people, and obviously that's less desirable than just putting somebody in a scanner. So what have we learned from these neuroimaging studies? Well, let's talk about a few different brain regions of interest. One of them is the ACC, the anterior cingulate cortex. And whenever I'm going to talk about brain regions and what they're involved in, first of all, I am not a highly trained neuroscientist. I'm a consumer of this information, and I may get some things wrong here, just a warning and a disclosure. Secondly, from my understanding of this, we don't have such clear mapping that says this structure always does this, because there's a tremendous amount of overlap. The brain can compensate. The brain can use different regions to do activities that are normally accomplished by other regions. Whether a person's left-handed or right-handed can change things. So there's a lot of complexity here. But there are still some general statements which most neurobiologists seem to agree on vis-a-vis the effects of mindfulness meditation and other meditation practices on brain structure and function. So one of these has to do with the ACC, the anterior cingulate cortex. And this is involved, among other things, in the integration of attention, motivation, and motor control. And here in one study that made quite a splash, is an older study now, 2007, it showed that novice meditators showed more activity than Buddhist monks who had done a lot of meditation. But regular meditators showed more activity than non-meditators. And this doesn't make sense initially, you'd think, well, wait a minute. If the novices show more than the Buddhist monks, you'd expect the regular meditators to be somewhere in between. But they actually had more activity than the novices. So what we have in terms of activity level is we have regular meditators showing the most activity, novices showing a medium amount of activity, and Buddhist monks showing the least amount of activity. What's up with that? Well, the hypothesis is that for the Buddhist monks, the activation of the of these capacities for attention and motor control are so second nature that they don't actually have to create a lot of activity in the ACC in order to accomplish those tasks. Regular meditators are working on developing attention, and they have this brain region operating at a high level because they're involved in trying to develop the skill. And the novices don't even really know how to go about getting it going. So they have more activity than the Buddhists. Monks, but they can't rev it up as much as the regular meditators. So this is again to say it's complicated. It's hard to say simple things because sometimes there aren't linear functions in which, oh, more meditation leads yields a change in a certain direction. I'd like to talk to you about the insula. This shows up in a lot of studies. And the insula is a small part of the brain. You can see where it is in the picture there. And the insula is associated with interoception, basically the visceral and gut feelings, noticing what's happening in the body. And it processes transient body sensations. Not a surprise, it's activated during meditation practice because most meditation practices involve paying attention to something going on in the body. And this paying attention to something going on in the body increases insula activity. So we know this. In fact, this is of great relevance for empathic resonance and reading other people and social intelligence, because part of how we understand other people is through what are called mirror neurons, which has to do with when another person is engaged in activity, let's say they're smiling or crying or looking red-faced, we feel in our own body empathically what they're feeling just being in their presence. And this happens when we watch somebody eat something if we're hungry. If you've ever watched a sexually explicit or violent film and felt sexual arousal or a sense of fear associated with violence, you know, just watching other people brings on these feelings in ourselves. So if the insula is active, we're going to be more in touch with what's going on inside this way. The amygdala is involved in helping to evaluate threats. That's going back to the type 2 errors. Is it a lion or is it a beige rock? The amygdala is activated when we're involved in a hypervigilant way trying to figure out what's going on here. And one more fact, and then we'll go to the findings about these things. Anxiety patients have the strongest amygdala activation to neutral faces. If you look at this slide here with happiness, neutral, and anger, these three different kinds of faces, when we know what's going on, people don't have so much amygdala activity with, oh my God, is it going to be okay? Like, oh, I get it, it's happy, oh, it's angry. But people with general anxiety disorder who are frequently anxious, when it's neutral and they can't figure out, you know, friend or foe, then they have the most activation of the amygdala. Okay, one more brain structure and then I'll weave it together. The prefrontal cortex is part of our thinking apparatus, and this evaluates emotional responses and helps to regulate emotion. So to go back to our lion and the beige rock, yes, it looks like a lion, but lions aren't generally found here, so it's probably a beige rock. This is our logical thinking capacity. So what do we see with training people in mindfulness practice? And this is people who went through an 8-week stress reduction mindfulness training course. And comparing them before the course and after the course, the mindfulness group had less amygdala activation. It decreased more. So they were less living in a world that looked dangerous. They experienced their world as less dangerous. They reported a decrease in anxiety, which goes along with that. And they had more activation of the prefrontal cortex. They were more able to kind of think about things rather than just react to them emotionally. And there were more connections between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, which is thought to involve being able to regulate the amygdala. In other words, being able to use sound judgment or even wisdom to modulate our reactivity. So now let's look at brain structure, where there have been, so that was about brain function. You know, what are we seeing going on in the brain? This is what we see about brain structure. Again, we talked about experience-dependent neuroplasticity. I talked about it with the London cabbies. We also see this in jugglers. We see it in musicians. Anybody who does anything, any mental task over a period of time, that part of the brain that's involved in that mental task tends to bulk up. As the psychologist Donald Hebb famously put it, neurons that wire together fire together, neurons that fire together wire together, so that if you fire neurons together a lot, they will wire together and they will bulk up in that way. So there have been many studies showing changes to brain structure. One of the first ones was in 2004 and 5 by Sarah Lazar at Massachusetts General Hospital. And Sarah happens to be a friend. She was a member of the Institute of Meditation and Psychotherapy for many years as our research advisor. And she studied long-term meditators and compared them to controls. In other words, people of roughly the same age who weren't meditators. And she found that they had a thicker anterior insula, thicker sensory cortex, which is involved in noticing sensations, and thicker prefrontal cortex. Again, this capacity to evaluate things. And the differences in thickness were most pronounced in older subjects. So if we go to the next slide, sorry, I'm having a little trouble finding the slides myself, where it says cortical areas that are thicker in meditators, and you see a picture of those areas. So the insula that we've been talking about, Brodmann's area 9-10, which is involved in, it has to do with speech, I believe, parts of the somatosensory cortex and parts of the auditory cortex were thicker in meditators. And look at this slide that says older meditators had greater gains. What you see in looking at thickness, and this is the insula in Brodmann's area, is that the blue dots represent the meditators and the control group is the red squares. And you see that the blue dots are roughly horizontal, whereas the red dots are trending lower as age goes up. I'm proud to say that I was one of those blue dots at age 50. I was involved in Sarah's study at the time, and it was fascinating to participate in it. I assume I'm one of the lower blue dots, given my own cognitive failures of late. But nonetheless, I was one of the blue dots. So what did she find? She found that in these various areas, meditation practice over a lifetime seemed to have a prophylactic effect in keeping parts of the brain from shrinking. There have been studies of Zen meditators. Here, this slide, Zen disappearing gray matter, where normally both attentional ability and cerebral gray matter volume shrink with age. In this study of Zen meditators, they didn't show less gray matter or attentional ability when they aged. They stayed intact. And there are other studies. Here's the pre-post increased gray matter density. And I know it's hard to take them all in, but I want to just give you a sense that a lot of different people have looked at this. And this is a situation in which the part of the hippocampus grew when people did an MBSR program. And the hippocampus is involved in memory, as we talked about with vis-a-vis the London cabbies, but it's also involved in learning, emotion regulation. And we see that the hippocampus actually shrinks in depression and anxiety. And here we see that it's growing. And there are other brain areas like the temporal parietal junction above the ear that has to do with perspective taking, empathy, and compassion, and that grew in the meditators as well. And a great shrinking amygdala study. You know, we've known that rats, if you put them in a into rat hell, which is basically an overcrowding situation, their amygdala will grow, and you can measure this and see this in the laboratory. So in this study, that's back from 2009, they found that humans, when they were assigned to, again, it was a, let me see here, an 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction course, that they actually saw the amygdala shrinking over the 8 weeks in these folks. So it's not like their external environment became less threatening objectively, but they related to their external environment as though it were less threatening. There was less amygdala activation, which we saw before. Now we're seeing that the amygdala actually shrinks over the course of 8 weeks. So now I'd like to shift to another effect of mindfulness practices. Now that we've seen that they change brain structure and brain function in desirable directions, and I want to talk about selfing. because it turns out that our preoccupation with ourselves and how we're doing and how we relate to others and the constant inner chatter about the inner report card, I'm doing well, I'm not, here I'm giving this webinar right now and I'm thinking, well, did I say that well? Did I not say that well? And some of that's useful for sure because it helps me to refine what I'm doing, but some of it's extra. Some of it is just like, so I feel good about myself if I say something well, I feel badly about myself if I feel I didn't say it so well. And this kind of constant self-evaluation causes a tremendous amount of suffering for all of us, again, because we can't live in Lake Wobegon and can't all be above average. So there's some fascinating work showing that mindfulness practices help us to be less involved in this constant self-critical pattern and this constant self-evaluation. And this work that I'm going to share with you is from Judson Brewer, who is, he's one of my favorite people in the field, bar none. He's a psychiatrist by training, but he's also a researcher by training. And he used to be at Yale, but now he's at the University of Massachusetts at the Center for Mindfulness and Medicine. And he's running up their research arm. And he's been looking at the effects of the effects in the brain, what's going on in the brain during selfing experiences and the effects of meditation on this. And I once heard him give a talk and he let me use his slide. So this is Judd's slide. And this is a picture of Lolo Jones. And she was favored to win the gold in the 2008 Beijing Olympics. And she was in the lead at the ninth of the 10 hurdles. And suddenly she got caught up in her own thinking. She got in her own way and the result wasn't pretty. If you look at the next slide, here's what she said. She said, "It was just an amazing rhythm. And then I knew at one point I was winning the race. It wasn't like, oh, I'm winning the Olympic gold medal. It just seemed like another race. And then there was a point after that, I was telling myself to make sure my legs were snapping out. So I overtried, and that's when I hit the hurdle. And instead of letting her body do what it had trained to do for years to be perfect for this shining moment in history, she tripped herself up. She started thinking about how well she was doing, and she tripped on the ninth of 10th hurdles and wound up finishing seventh. Tragic, well, not tragic, it's not cancer, but sad tale for somebody who's an Olympic athlete. But it turns out that getting in our own way plays a huge role in making us unhappy and making us function less well. And let me step back for a moment. It turns out, people who study this say that there are two types of self-reference. One of them is what they call a narrative focus, which is where we're talking to ourselves about ourselves and we're talking about enduring traits. This is where I'm saying all day long, oh, Ron's smart. Oh, Ron's dumb. Oh, Ron's a nice guy. Oh, Ron's actually self-centered and mean. Ron's compassionate. Oh, Ron's narcissistic and selfish. Ron's thin, Ron's overweight, Ron's strong, Ron's weak, Ron's healthy, Ron's not. All of these talking to ourselves about ourselves and how we're doing is this narrative focus. The other focus, the experiential focus, is what we do in mindfulness practice. This simply noticing moment to moment the arising of a sensation in the belly, a sound, an itch, an ache, a feeling of joy, a feeling of sadness, a wave of fear, just staying with the mind-body moment by moment. So two types of self-reference, narrative where we're talking to ourselves about ourselves and evaluating ourselves and just being with experience moment by moment. And there's a part of a region of the brain or a series of regions of the brain known as the default mode network. And this was discovered when they put people in functional MRI machines. And what they did was they would be giving them various tests to do to study what parts of the brain were active in various activities. But in between tests, the people would just be lying there. And they started noticing that there was a distinct brain pattern going on when people were just lying there. And this was the activation of the default mode network. And when they investigated further to see what's going on when the default mode network comes online is actually people are involved in mind wandering. And a lot of that mind wandering is self-referential processing, thinking about me, how I'm doing, what I'm going to do, what I like, what I don't like, and how I compare to others are major themes that are occurring in consciousness when the default mode network is activated. So they've tried seeing, well, does meditation practice, does mindfulness practice have an effect on this default mode network, on this network that's involved in selfing? And indeed, and this was Brewer's research, he found that experienced and he had experienced and novice meditators doing three practices: focused attention, which is, I mentioned before, where you focus on a given object like the breath and return your attention to it regularly. Open monitoring, or mindfulness itself, where you allow the mind to go to whatever predominates in consciousness, but you're aware of where your attention is in each moment. And various acceptance and loving kindness practices, where you're soothing yourself, you're taking care of yourself in different ways. And it turns out that the main nodes of the default mode network were deactivated in all of these processes. Now, Judd did something really interesting. He actually programmed a computer to focus on one part of the default mode network called the posterior cingulate cortex, the PCC. And if we look at this slide, and what he did was he taught the computer, taught or programmed the computer to create red upward spikes whenever the PCC was active and blue downward spikes when it was quiet. And here's what we saw. So this is a meditator, and here again, this is Judd's research and his slides, a meditator describing what happens. Remember, the red upward spikes are the PCC's activated, the blue downward spikes are it's relatively quiescent. So at the beginning, I caught myself that I was sort of trying to guess, and please show the slide, when the meditation was going to begin. So I was kind of trying to be like, okay, ready, set, go. And then there was an additional word that popped in, and I was like, oh, shit. And so that's the red spike you see there. So when they had the evaluative thought of, oh, shit, you got a red spike. And then, next slide, then I sort of immediately settled in, and I was really getting into it. And you see the blue line going downward. Next slide. And then I thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. It's describing exactly what I'm saying. And then you see the red spike, thinking, oh yeah, I got it. It's going well. You see the red spike. And I was like, okay, wait, don't get distracted. And then I got back into it, experiential, into an experiential sense of self. And then it got blue again. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable. It's doing exactly what my mind is doing. And so it got red again. So every time the person had a self-evaluative thought about how I'm doing, you see the red spikes. And Judd's been actively trying to figure out ways to get this out of the laboratory so that people could actually practice with this kind of neurofeedback, less selfing, less self-preoccupation. And final slide here. So I just find it really funny because that's, to the next question, that's a perfect map of what my mind was going through. Okay, so let's go to the next slide where mindfulness reduces selfing. So there are several areas involved in this. One of them is called the medial prefrontal cortex, which tends to link subjective experiences over time. And this holds memories of self traits, traits of similar others, reflected self-knowledge, future aspirations. It's another part of the default mode network, which is very active when we're thinking about ourselves and evaluating ourselves. So in this study, half the subjects were put in an 8-week MBSR course. And they were all trained in narrative focus and experiential focus. Again, talking to ourselves about our traits versus staying with moment by moment what's happening in the body. The narrative focus would be thoughts like, I'm a nice person, I'm a mean person, I'm a smart person, I'm a wealthy person, whereas the experiential is just, oh, sensation in the belly, oh, feeling in the shoulder, etc. And they were asked to do each approach when in an fMRI machine. And in the novices, indeed, when they went to experiential focus, when they stayed with what was happening in the body, it reduced self-referential activity in the medial prefrontal cortex. But in the people who had been through the mindfulness training, the experiential focus resulted in much more marked and pervasive reduced activity in the medial prefrontal cortex, along with increased engagement in several other areas. So we saw that anybody could shift from narrative to experiential focus, but if you've done a bunch of these practices, you're better at it. You're better at getting out of your own way. You get better at not identifying so much with self-esteem issues. So the conclusion is that there's a fundamental neurodissociation between these two forms of self-awareness, the self across time, the evaluative self, traits, and the unfolding of experiences moment by moment. And mindfulness practice helps us to see them to be separate and to see how the self is created out of a narrative, to really hold this in perspective. And this dovetails with a number of philosophic perspectives. Slide with Einstein, please. This is what Einstein said about it. He said, a human being is part of the whole called by us universe. We experience ourselves, our thoughts and feelings as something separate from the rest. a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. And this delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from the prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty. The true value of a human being is determined by the measure and the sense in which they've obtained liberation from the self. So these neurobiological studies of mindfulness are showing us that we can obtain, to a degree, liberation from the self by doing these practices. Next slide. This is what Dogen, the 13th century Zen master, said. To study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. To be enlightened by all things is to be free from attachment to the body and mind of oneself and of others. So this has enormous potential. And we come to see, if you look at the picture of the fellow taking a selfie from his cell phone in the next slide, that we start to experience the self as a verb, not a noun. We start to see who we are as a process with these things unfolding. And we respond very differently when we see it as a process of moment-to-moment experiences than when we get into all the distortion that happens when we have to build up our self-esteem. And all we have to do is look at the explosion of narcissism in our culture these days to recognize that when we're hooked on self-esteem and hooked on social comparison, it can make us quite miserable. So a few words about a few other areas that mindfulness can help us with and the neurobiology of it. One has to do with the study of compassion. And it turns out that we have, and this is mostly Paul Gilbert who's mapped this out, who's developed compassion-focused therapy in the United Kingdom. We basically have three broad motivational systems as humans. One is the fight, flee, or fight response system. If you look at the slide, that's in your upper left-hand corner. And that's where we respond to potential threats. That's where the amygdala is getting activated and triggering that system. We know neurobiologically that adrenaline is the main neurotransmitter involved in that, the main hormone involved in that. And we all know what it's like when that's activated. A second system on the right-hand upper right-hand side is the drive, excitement, and vitality system. This is the system by which we look for new engagement, we try to achieve things, we try to get food and shelter and sex, or we go to graduate school. We do all sorts of things like this. And this system is seeking pleasure. It tends to be activating, and dopamine plays a big role in this. This is the part of those of you who remember the old study by Olds and Milner back in the 1950s, where they implanted an electrode in the brain of rats and in this drive system having to do with this reward of drive and achievement. And the rat would press the lever to give itself an electrical stimulus there to the exclusion of even eating because it felt so good. And this system's activated by cocaine and other things. And then there's this third system, which is the affiliative mammalian tendon befriend system. It's our love system. It's our compassion system. And this, the main hormone or neurotransmitter here is oxytocin, and it comes from the pituitary, and fibers go into the brain. And this is what happens when we're giving care to others, when we're caring for ourselves. And as we know, so many of us get stuck in either responding to threats or seeking achievements in such a way that we lose connection with being able to be loving to ourselves, we lack self-compassion, or we lose the capacity to be loving toward others. Next slide. So these three systems, the safety, satisfaction, and connection system, the safety fight or flight system goes way back to the reptiles. You can see our lizard in the upper left-hand corner. The satisfaction system was more developed in mammals. You see that in our rat. But this mammalian tendon befriend system, while it exists in rats and others, primates have really taken this to the next level, where we really learn how to care for our young over a long period of time. And the capacity for love this way is so essential for cooperation. It's so essential for getting along. And what we know from studies of this is that when people do mindfulness meditation, they become more compassionate. When they do deliberate compassion practices, they become more compassionate. So we know that these practices And in some of the studies of this, we've seen that the degree to which there are changes in the neurobiology of this, the degree to which we see this tandem befriend system coming online neurobiologically, correlates to the degree to which people actually act more generously and compassionately in the world. So I just want to touch on one other area, and then we'll open this up to questions. And this has to do with mindfulness and pain. And this refers both to physical pain and emotional pain and what we know of the neurobiology of this. Excuse me. So there's a famous sutra by the Buddha talking about this. It's called The Story of the Two Arrows. And it says, when touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his or her breast, becomes distraught. So the person feels two pains, physical and mental, just as if they were to shoot a person with an arrow and right afterwards were to shoot him or her with another one. So the person would feel the pains of two arrows. I was talking about this to a patient who works at MIT, and he said, as people who work at MIT frequently do, there's a mathematical formula for that. And if we look at the next slide, we'll see this. The mathematical formula is pain times resistance equals suffering. If pain is very great, you've literally been shot by an arrow. Even if you're a good mindfulness student and you're not resisting it too much, they'll still be suffering. But oftentimes pain is moderate. I don't know if you've ever, I remember, you know, in the early days of my mindfulness practice, my mindfulness retreat practice, and this was before we had Eastern equine encephalitis or West Nile virus, we were told, don't kill anything if you don't have to. And I'd be sitting there meditating and I'd hear and you know, when the sound stops, that's when the trouble starts. And sometimes I could actually see the mosquito, and I could see the mosquito dig its proboscis, or that front part, into my skin, inject the anticoagulant, fill up with blood, the whole back part of the mosquito fills up, and fly away to make new mosquitoes. And you'd see then the little red bump would emerge. And the whole thing was not only not aversive, it was kind of cool. It was like having your own little National Geographic film right on your wrist. And contrast this to when we're fighting mosquitoes out on the porch or so. So resistance plays a huge role. And we see through mindfulness practice that pain is separate from suffering. Suffering is the resistance to the pain. But if we can simply allow it to be there, we don't suffer so much. Impermanence is a gift, not just a curse, because we see that the pain comes and goes. And these apparently solid pain states, we start to see them that they're not solid, that they're constantly changing. This loops back to this earlier idea we talked about embracing change. And we learn through mindfulness practice that you really can separate the two arrows, that the pain is inevitable, but the suffering is optional. And the suffering is grincing, wincing, embracing, all the aversive thoughts, I hate this, wishes for relief, when's it gonna stop? The self-punitive thoughts, I never should have let the mosquito bite me or whatever, and the anger, whatever, fear, depression about the condition. So what do we know about mindfulness and neurobiology here? Well, there was a wonderful study in which they did experimentally induced pain. And what they did was they took meditators and novices and they put them in a functional MRI machine and they applied a heat laser to their feet that were sticking out of the machine. And what did they find? Well, first, they found that in the meditators, there was a lot of insula activity, the part of the brain we discussed before that involves feeling sensations, but not so much prefrontal activity. This is the part of the brain that evaluates sensations but might also get involved in thinking, I hate this, when's this going to stop, how long is this going to last? The non-meditators had less insula activity, so they were probably noticing less vividly, less high resolution what was happening in the body, but had a lot of prefrontal activity, a lot of thinking about it. And what did we find when they asked people about the experience? Well, the experienced meditators found the pain to be less unpleasant. They could observe the pain less reactively. They found that by just opening to it, it reduced the pain unpleasantness, and they had less anticipatory pain anxiety. They had less anxiety prior to the stimulus. And as we see in this next slide, the neurobiology of pain, we see that the meditators who were doing open monitoring, when exposed to the pain, had decreased activity in the lateral prefrontal cortex, as I mentioned, that evaluates the sensation, and increased activation in the posterior insula registering sensation. So we saw that the story of the two arrows, if you will, actually plays out neurobiologically, that we feel stuff more vividly, but we're less reactive to it, and we fight it less, and we suffer less. And this doesn't just apply to physical pain, because all emotional pain is also physical pain. If you generate a little bit of sadness right now, you can feel that as a pressure in your chest or in your throat or your eyes, or anger or anxiety. These are all the difficult emotions are physical sensations. So if we can learn to be with them in this way, we're going to do much better this way. So let's just bring this to the last slide here, which is simply, I haven't been teaching meditation, I've been talking about the neurobiology of mindfulness practices. If you'd like to learn the practices themselves, many, many outlets for that. One of them is to go to mindfulness-solution.com, which you see on your screen there. And it's a website associated with one of the books I wrote, which is The Mindfulness Solution. But on this website, you can get free downloads or streaming of all sorts of meditation practices to take up the practices yourself. So that was a bit of a whirlwind tour through mindfulness and the neurobiology of mindfulness and how it might be of use to us. But I hope it was of interest to you. And I'm now more than happy to hear your comments or questions.
Thank you so much, Ron. I would like to extend this invitation to our participants. You can submit your questions by entering them into the field just below this video. Ron, I want to take you back to a little bit of a reference that you made to the negativity bias. And I'd heard you say in a lecture once that courage is about doing what needs to be done, even as you feel the fear. I'd like to know how this can be applied in an experience of trauma or PTSD or some sort of severe discomfort that arises as we're trying to cultivate courage.
Well, there's always a ratio between our felt capacity to be able to bear or tolerate or accept some kind of unpleasant experience and the intensity of that experience. It's often called in the trauma field a window of tolerance. You know, how much can I bear here? Dan Siegel, Pat Ogden, and others like to use that term. So there's always a question for any one of us, which is, how well resourced am I in this moment? I'm sure Rick Hansen talked about that yesterday. To what extent am I able to feel safely connected to others, feel like I'm in a safe environment, feel like I can handle what comes up and it's going to be okay? If we're feeling well-resourced, then we can turn our attention to whatever is painful, and we'll see the two arrows, what we saw neurobiologically, this capacity to be with pain actually increases in meditators, because we mount less resistance. We get less caught in the thought stream, less caught in the prefrontal cortical activity, thinking, well, when's it going to stop? And I hate it and all of that. So we're actually able to feel it more fully, more deeply, and have a greater window of tolerance. But when somebody has had bad trauma, we want to modulate that. We want to be conscious of, is this going to be a good time and place for them to do this, or is this going to be destabilizing? Because sometimes it can be destabilizing. But ultimately, where we want to go with this therapeutically, and this fits the neurobiology of the two-arrow story, if you will, where we want to go is increasing our capacity to bear things, so that instead of trying to avoid anxiety, or for that matter, even avoid sadness or anger or physical pain, we're willing and able to open to it. This also helps to tie it back to another part of the lecture. If we're not so identified with it, if we're not involved in a lot of selfing, like, oh, because I'm feeling anxiety, that means I'm a nervous person, and nervous people aren't very strong and courageous, so I'm not a very good person, because being strong and courageous is good, but being anxious is not. And many of us, when we're anxious, we feel that way, right? We're filled with all sorts of self-criticism about that. If we're less identified with those thoughts and able to just feel the fear, and we're less involved in self-evaluation generally, it's going to be easier to feel the feelings, because we won't add a whole layer of judgment on top of that.
We've got a question from Amal that has to do with selfing. She writes, how do we reach a balance between the good selfing versus too much of it? Also, how can we identify when we're being caught in too much mindful brain, what she has here in parentheses, i.e. lazy or non-motivated?
Okay, well, this touches on a number, excellent question. It touches on a number of different points. First of all, there's a lot of people use a lot of different words to describe different aspects of selfing. And there is, you know, there's self-compassion, which is where we're able to hold ourselves as a mother would hold one's child when we're in pain. That's not about comparative self-esteem. That's not thinking how good I am or how bad I am. That's simply being loving toward oneself. There's appreciating that, hey, I can walk. That's so great. Oh, it's fun. My mind works. What a delight. Oh, you know, wow, that tennis stroke felt great. The kind of selfing that I'm referring to that becomes more problematic hinges on social comparison. It's when we're thinking, how am I doing compared to other people? And sometimes it's explicit, we're actually competing with somebody. Sometimes it's implicit, where it's when we're evaluating ourselves compared to some inner ideal or some model of who we think we should be. And I would argue that that kind of social comparative selfing has outlived its usefulness. While it made sense on the African savannah, because if you had a higher dominance rank, as I was describing in the, you know, the various groups of mammals there, if you were more dominant, you were going to be able to spread your DNA. So you were going to be able to, in terms of natural selection, you would prevail because you were going to have, if you're a male, sexual relations with more reproductively promising females. If you're a female, you'd have the care, protection, and connection with the dominant male, which is very good for your kid's survival. So it's very hardwired in us to want to feel good compared to others. And also, nobody wants to be ostracized. You know, the fear that if I'm not good in some way, I'll be thrown out of the primate troop. And since we evolved in groups of 25 to 50 primates in the African savannah, being thrown out of the troop was a death sentence. So we don't want that to happen either. So we're very hardwired to be concerned with social comparison. But I'd say it's largely outlived its usefulness, and that much as we're hardwired to enjoy fat and sugar, eating donuts all day would just make us sick. And there are aspects of our hardwiring too has outlived its usefulness. So I would argue that we don't have to worry. We can give up selfing and still have all sorts of interest in the world, still be interested in doing things, in engagement with others, where it's not so much a competition, but it's more a full embracing of the experience. And the fantasy that if we do more mindfulness practice and we learn how to be aware of present experience with acceptance, we're going to lose all our motivation and be lazy because we won't be driven by anxious thoughts of achievement and falling behind and all of that, turns out to be a fantasy. People who do a lot of mindfulness practice are quite productive. In fact, they have more access to more resources because the constant preoccupation with, is this going to make me feel good or bad, is no longer getting in the way of doing what needs to be done.
Charlie writes, "My partner and I have committed to meditation practice together, but we keep hitting snags whenever we have disagreements. I can't trust the process or my partner enough to surrender to loving kindness in those moments. It feels too passive or weak. Is this normal?"
Well, everything's normal. And in fact, the whole question about what's normal or not probably has to do with our anxiety about, are we doing good enough and how do we compare to others? But I assume he's talking about conflictual moments. And, you know, that's very tricky because a lot is needed in a moment of conflict. On the one hand, we, you know, it may be important for us to share our perspective, to let the other person know that what they did hurt our feelings in some way, and that we're feeling anger as a result of that. That kind of communication may be an important corrective, so the other person knows, oh, all right, I need to be more gentle around that. I need to be more careful. Sometimes doing things like loving kindness practice, where we're intentionally generating loving and kind feelings toward ourselves and toward others, can be helpful because it can take the anger down a notch. When anger is revved up to a high pitch, often it's not very useful. You know, we're not able to communicate, and we need it to be in a much more, again, within this window of tolerance, within this middle range where we can work with it. But I'd say that if what you're doing is you find yourself doing loving kindness practice, and what's happening is another part of you is coming to the surface, which is still feeling angry, hurt, aggrieved, like there's been an injustice, well, then that part also is going to need some attention here. And the, you know, the art is finding the balance among all of these. And I don't think it's easy. I mean, I don't find it easy. I've been at these practices for, 4+ decades. I've been a clinical psychologist for, 3.5 decades. And I still don't know how to manage an argument optimally. You know, I don't know what the best balance is between stating my feelings and my needs and listening to the other person and trying to generate loving kindness. I think we're always trying to feel our way here.
Well, for me, this brings up what you mentioned about the mirror neurons. I wonder what the best practice is for maintaining one's boundaries when we're feeling maybe a little anxious around difficult conversations or those conflictual experiences.
Yeah, you know, Carl Rogers, who was a genius, and I used to think early in my clinical training that, oh, Carl Rogers is the baby course because that's what they teach you in the first counseling course. But I now think if any of us could do what Rogers said, we would be a master clinician. And Rogers famously said that empathy is feeling the feeling of another as though it's one's own without giving up the awareness that it's not one's own. So when the mirror neurons are activated, when we're with another person and they're feeling a strong feeling, and we start to feel that feeling in our own body, it's a matter of noticing that, yes, indeed, this is occurring here, but also noticing that it's occurring through an act of resonance. It's occurring because I'm with this other person. And in general, what mindfulness practices help us to do is to not identify with any of the thoughts or feelings. This is how they help us with the selfing part that we now see this, you know, wonderful neurobiological evidence for that yes, sadness arises, yes, anger arises, yes, fear arises, but the narrative that I'm angry at you because you did this to me, or I'm so hurt because of what you did, that gets quieter. We get less identified with those thoughts. We're more able to let the narrative thoughts come and go. And when we can let them come and go, two things happen. One is we have a greater capacity to feel the feelings. Again, this the insula activation that we were talking about before. We identify less with the thoughts about them. So we're not caught in the prefrontal activation in that way. And they can arise and pass more readily. You know, it's said there are some cognitive scientists studying this, and I don't know exactly how the study was set up, but I've heard the conclusion repeated, which is, the question is, how long does an emotion last if not reinforced by a thought that we believe in? And the answer is something like 90 seconds. You know, there's the physical arousal of the emotion, but if it's not reinforced by some thought we believe in, it comes and goes. And mindfulness practice helps us not believe in our thoughts so much. It helps us to see them as these passing phenomena. And that very much helps to free us. And it makes it easier in a conflictual situation to not just dig in our heels or feel like our point has to prevail.
Bill asks, can you comment on your understanding of the difference between deliberate mindfulness, which you've been discussing, and effortless mindfulness, which is apparently a more advanced practice?
Well, I don't know exactly what Bill means by effortless mindfulness. I mean, there are moments where mindfulness simply arises, where we're simply aware of our present experience with acceptance without deliberate effort. And indeed, when people do a lot of practice, like I have good friends, Bill and Susan Morgan, who they're psychotherapists, who basically did roughly a 4-year silent retreat where there were breaks to it, but basically for 4 years, they spent most days doing mindfulness practice. And I asked them, I remember talking to Bill in particular about this, so, you know, what was it like? And he said, well, one thing that happens is mindfulness happens more by itself at that point. Now, I've been at this for quite a few decades, and I find that, yeah, to some degree, mindfulness happens by itself, but it happens a lot more if I do deliberate mindfulness practice. So, you know, there's so many different, when we had the Dalai Lama at a conference at Harvard, and, you know, we asked him to lead 1,100 psychotherapists in a meditation, and he just started laughing in his inimitable way, as though, you know, what will these silly psychologists and others come up with next? And he said, you know, there are thousands of different forms of meditation. And because the mind is so complex and there are so many different ways that you can get into trouble, you know, knowing which kind of practice is going to be most useful when, that's tough. You know, there's not one practice that's good for everybody. So I'm not exactly sure what Bill means by effortless mindfulness, but suffice it to say, there are many, many, many different practices that all fall under the mindfulness umbrella, and some will be more useful for some people at some moments than others.
Okay. James asks, when you mentioned state versus trait, I wondered what we could cultivate and expand in ourselves, kind of like nature versus nurture. Is it possible to develop a trait for mindfulness and presence in the moment?
Absolutely. In fact, that's, you know, part of what I was trying to describe there, and I'm sorry if it was a little condensed, is that in looking at state versus trait, we're both, when people take up mindfulness practices, we're looking at what's happening in this moment when they're actually doing mindfulness meditation, you know, in, let's say, the functional MRI machine, and then what changes over time happen to their brain and what changes over time happen to their patterns of brain function. And those are traits. And we know that there are measurable changes in trait mindfulness, in other words, in the general propensity to be mindful, that happen to people when they deliberately do these practices over time. So both have been measured, and the neurobiologists are interested in looking at both. So that's what I was talking about with the state and trait. The conclusion is that mindfulness both changes our state in the moment, and it changes these enduring traits as well.
Sylvia writes, in our overstimulated culture, I worry that my brain and attention span have been compromised in many ways. What does research have to say about the actual makeup of our brains in this age of technology and competition for our attention?
Well, welcome to the club. you know, Google says, I believe, that we check our smartphone 145 times a day, and my guess is it's a low estimate, or maybe it's an old estimate. That was from some years ago. I think this is just accelerating. I guess somebody would have to do the study of taking modern people in industrialized cultures and doing a bunch of brain scanning of them, and then take folks in cultures that are relatively unexposed to this, and see what happens. Although, gosh, you know, cell phone penetration is pretty high almost everywhere. And of course, you know, in studying the different groups, it would be very difficult to tell, are we studying other aspects of cultural difference? Are we studying the effects of diet? Are we studying the effects of exercise? Or, you know, what are we studying here when we see differences in the brain? Because, again, it would be very hard to randomize two children, one to, you know, let's say 25 years of development without computers, smartphones, et cetera, who, you know, just reads the occasional book and goes fishing, versus the other who grows up in you know, modern society. It's hard to tell. So when we're scanning people's brains, everybody's exposed to this stuff. So it's really hard to know what we're looking at. My intuition, based on my own experience of sometimes doing more screen time and sometimes doing less screen time, is indeed my attention span goes down when I spend more time with screens. My sensitivity to stimuli is reduced when I spend more time with media. That there's a real price to be paid for this.
Now, I picked up somewhere, it might have been through one of your talks or lectures or something that I read along the way, but you said something about single tracking and or single tasking.
Single tasking, as opposed to
multitasking. Could you say a little bit more about that and how that can cultivate a sense of spaciousness and presence in our lives?
And mindfulness, actually. Mm-hmm. In fact, one definition of mindfulness practices, it's single tasking. It's learning to do one thing at a time and noticing what we're doing as we're doing it. And many of us have the fantasy that we can multitask. And you see this particularly among young people, you know, teenagers who say, oh yeah, I have no trouble at all. you know, being on Facebook at the same time that I'm listening to music, at the same time that I'm playing a video game and doing my calculus homework. Well, cognitive scientists would beg to differ. They'd say attention is like a pie. And if we try to multitask on two items, each one gets 50% of the attention, four items, 25%, and on, that we actually don't have this capacity. And that's why so many states have passed laws. I thought it was, you know, almost humorous when Massachusetts, where I live, passed a law saying no texting while driving, as though one could conceive of texting while driving being a reasonable idea. But they had to pass a law. And in fact, I was just reading all of our insurance premiums are going up. And the main reason for that is distraction based on people being on their cell phone seems to be also it's more expensive to repair complex automobiles, but distraction is actually causing more accidents despite the fact that we have more safety devices, but people are less attentive. So the alternative of just deciding, you know, as much as possible, I'm going to single task. So when I eat a sandwich, instead of eating a sandwich and reading my email and checking my news feed and listening to music, I'm just going to eat the sandwich and taste it. You know, when I go for a walk, instead of having something in my ears and having, you know, entertainment or being in a conversation, I'm going to actually experience my feet on the ground and the sights and sounds of nature. These are all informal mindfulness practices that we can do to cultivate a more mindful attitude and to some degree to balance the societal tendency toward more distraction. Or if, I don't know if Rick mentioned this last night, but he's fond of saying that we're drinking from the fire hose of information.
Mm. Right. We've got time for one final question, and I'd like to ask you to share a simple practice with us that we might be able to go to as we cultivate our own practice of mindfulness or presence in our daily lives.
Well, the simplest one and the one that many people begin with, although it can be overwhelming for some people if they have a lot of unresolved trauma or the like, is to simply, you know, take a moment, find a posture that's alert and relaxed. So you might sit up straight for a moment if you're sitting, and you might close your eyes for this for a moment, and just notice the sensations of the breath in the body and notice how it feels to be sitting here if you're sitting. And just allow yourself to feel the breath. To gently incline the attention out of the thought stream and toward moment-to-moment sensations. And since it would not be unusual for thoughts to arise, when thoughts arise, allow them to come and allow them to go. Just gently and lovingly returning the attention to the sensations of sitting here and the sensations of the breath in the body. And that simple practiced over time, can actually bring about all the neurobiological changes that I've been discussing in this presentation.
Ron, thank you so much for that and for everything that you shared. That felt really good.
Thanks very much for having me.
Mm-hmm. This concludes the fourth live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. Thanks once again to Dr. Ronald Siegel for this outstanding presentation. Please note that the recording of this session will remain accessible for free for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. I'd also like to thank everyone who joined us tonight. We really appreciated your participation as well. Please join us for our next live session with Dr. Stephen Porges, and that's going to take place tomorrow on March 22nd, 2017 at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. For Sounds True, I'm Christy Peoples, and thanks again for joining us. SoundsTrue.com, many voices, one journey.